Hi guys, welcome to the Accounting Tech Tar Pit, presented by Early Adopters Hub, the accelerator for accounting tech. I'm your host, Jack Teal, and this is a podcast for accounting tech startup founders focused on no BS, candid conversations about the challenges and benefits of building a startup in the accounting industry. Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of the Accounting Tech Tar Pit. We're joined by a very special guest today who has been all over the world and worked in a numerous world-renowned companies, starting his days as a trainee accountant at Deloitte, moving on to eventually head up divisions at both Barclays Africa and Standard Bank South Africa, and is now running, I guess, you know, you tell me, one of the fastest growing fintechs in Australia, Patron. You assure me you have a lot of battle scars that you're keen to share and you're willing to share, which is awesome. That's what this podcast is all about, sharing those challenges and, you know, what you've overcome and maybe those things that, you know, you look back and would have taken a different approach if you were there again. So, Francois Henrion, great to have you here.
Hey, Jack, Johan, great to be here. Thank you for inviting me. Quick introduction, I'm one of the two co-founders of Patron. Jaco Veldsman is the other co-founder. Very humble to be on here. You know, I think you guys obviously see something in Patron that's some sort of a measure of success, and we're grateful for that, but recognize there are many measurements of success out there, you know, and many lessons to be learned. So happy to take you through our journey. Of where we've gotten lucky, you know, what we thought we may have done right, and probably a lot of the mistakes that we've dodged or learned from.
No, our pleasure to have you. And I think as somebody who is so well versed and has such an impressive CV, what always impresses me is your humbleness and open-mindedness, Francois. So I look forward to the discussion today. I guess as maybe a quick starting point, it's certainly not outrageous to me based on your background in banking and as a chartered accountant that you are building a fintech. But I am curious to know, you know, how you ended up getting into the startup game. You were working at world-renowned businesses in great roles. So yeah, can you talk us through that journey, how you ended up building a startup and any maybe challenges and mistakes you made along the way?
Yeah, I suppose there's that saying that goes, you know, the more you practice, the luckier you get. We really got lucky in the sense that Jaco and I met each other. But it's the background and I suppose the hard work that you did in the past that led to that specific fork in the road. My story is that I recently, well, it feels like recently, about 3 years ago, came to Australia. I had not thought about finding a job or going into corporate yet. And when the idea was planted to potentially start my own thing, I thought, well, you know, going and starting a career in a new country versus starting a business could be the same thing. So when I met Jaco, you know, it just made sense to try something because, yeah, you found yourselves with somebody that had a very similar background to you from a technical perspective and a knowledge-based perspective, somebody that has a very similar risk appetite, somebody that has a vision to do something. And to a certain extent, the financial means to take the risk. So you have so many stars that align to actually go along a journey with the founder that, you know, when those did align, we thought it would be an opportunity wasted not to just have a go at something, to be honest. We didn't know what it was, but we knew we wanted to do something together.
Yeah, awesome. And so now, having been on that journey for a couple of years, what's your most recent milestone and what's kind of on the horizon for Patron?
I think the most recent milestone is just having confidence for the first time. You know, the initial months you go through, and I suppose we'll touch on fundraising a little bit, is you second doubt yourself all the time. You know, you second doubt yourself because, as you said, you know, humbly speaking, our CVs are quite impressive. So when people give you money, they're to a large extent investing in you as a founder, and they back you to figure it out. So they're not backing the idea really. So you do second doubt yourself a lot and you look for a lot of market validation and you keep building, you know, building product, building features in the hope to find it. And 2 and a bit years into the journey now, we're fully confident around product market fit and we're in that scale phase now. And I'd say that's the biggest achievement for us. Going forward, where do we go? I think we're pretty much done with product expansion. We can touch a bit on the complexities of building vertical businesses versus horizontal businesses that are suited to start off with. I'd like to spend some time on that. But I think we've done the horizontal component now. There's nothing more to build. There's depth that we may need to go into. And then geographical expansion. You know, where do we go next? Where do we launch? Where do we go and try and find product and market fit in other countries?
Yeah, okay. Well, that is interesting. And you mentioned raising, and you mentioned where you're at with the product and going international as well. So we'll try and touch on each of those if I can remember later on. But maybe as a starting point, let's speak about, you know, raising capital and that process that you've been through. You and Jaco both have fantastic CVs, and as you said, you know, you start to wonder, are people investing in us or in our idea? Does that matter? That's something that kind of comes to my mind is, you know, why does that matter if it does?
I don't think it matters initially, but down the road it matters. When you get to your, you know, Series A, Series B, I think it starts to matter. So you have this grace period of about a year, 18 months, where you know you're allowed to figure things out. Then the pressure starts, right? And you need to show those results for the money that you've spent. So I think having aligning your vision with the investor's vision is very important on that, on you know where you're about to spend that money and how you're about to scale. And we've you know through talking to very many VC funds out there, you definitely get areas of expertise in certain areas. So I would you know if I was starting the journey again, I would do a lot of homework around investors that are particularly active in a certain industry and understand the industry, because they can then you know support you and help you on that particular journey, so you're not completely alone. And you know that's something that I would definitely focus on.
Have you found that support in you know in the journey so far, and what does that look like? You know, what should a founder maybe expect of good investors, and what's the value back other than just the capital?
I suppose that, you know, when you're starting a business, there's three routes that you could take, right? One is bootstrap it. One is to raise capital from a venture capital firm, and one's from a corporate firm. And all of those have very, very different outcomes. When you take venture capital money, it's quite a it's the pace increases and the expectations increase. And especially as I would say, as an Australian based company with a relatively small market in certain areas, you know, when you attract foreign capital, the pressure is on to go global. And so that's a very, very different proposition to, let's say, getting a corporate investor from day one who has an existing customer base that's proven in the domestic market, and then need you to scale with them and go on a journey with them. Bootstrapping on the other end, you know, is also a very, very different process. I would say that really depends on the complexity of the product that you're building. So let's maybe touch on vertical versus horizontal businesses. Patreon is a horizontal business. And what means is, you know, we have many verticals within the business. And to complicate matters even further is we are a regulated financial institution. So we're a payments company that is expensive. So it's not a company that you can bootstrap. It just requires a lot of money to get off the ground, a lot of technical expertise, risk management, operations, people to build a product, to run the product, and to effectively look after our clients' money. So that's an expensive exercise. So consider that when you see an opportunity out there. You know, are you going to financial service? Do you really want to go to fintech? Or do you have some sort of a software solution that doesn't tackle that? So if it's the latter, sure. You know, you can definitely go and bootstrap, you can find product market within a specific vertical, just build one product out there, do it really well, get a couple of customers, use the money to, you know, to start hiring, start building out the business. But obviously the red lights around that is the reason we built a horizontal business is the barrier to entry is super high. You know, so it's not, the opportunity is not that clear. So it may not be that clear to the investors. It may not be that clear to your target market. But once the lights actually go on, the attrition is super low. So, you know, your customer retention is significant. And you actually build a scalable business and you ward off potential competitors. We're going back to the vertical business. If the opportunity is super clear, everybody gets into it. So you look at the buy now, pay laters of the world, did phenomenally well. It was a well understood problem. It was easy for a lot of people to get into, but then it quickly gets overcrowded and then devalued after that. So I think the summary is that you have to have a relatively good understanding of what the 2-3 year journey, 4 year journey looks like before you start journey day one. It affects how you raise capital and what type of business you build.
Francois, just to jump in with my one maybe final question regarding investment side. I mean, obviously quite often founders, especially when it's just an idea with no traction, they're at a disadvantage when they talk to investors. How do you balance that need for cash now, but actually making sure you get investors that align with what you're trying to achieve long term, so you're not going to be in 5, 6, 7 years looking back like, oh shit, I should have never taken that investor on board, no matter how much I needed the money back then?
That's a super good question, and something that you can only answer with retrospect. You get warned of this up front. People tell you, you know, raise money from the right investors. And a lesson that I'm learning, and I continue to learn, is I would say that I was relatively arrogant in the beginning, thinking that I have built businesses within businesses, which I've done in large organizations. I incubated businesses and ran them successfully. And I thought, you know, how's that any different to just building a startup? And I couldn't understand why people placed value on a second time founder. And now I get it. Like, I completely get why it is easier to raise funding when you're a second time founder, because you can probably walk in day one in a seed round and raise 10 million or 20 million or 50, whatever the number is, based on your idea, because you have a proven track record in that. So I think that's your first challenge. First time founder is going to be a lot harder than a second time founder to raise the capital. Then I suppose is, do you have choice? You know, if you have the financial means to you know, run it for yourself for a bit, I would spend a lot of time finding the right investor. You don't know what right looks like, obviously, until you've been through it. But sometimes you are forced to just take the cash, and you'll have to deal with that the situation later on. What's also important to notice is that some investors are purely early stage, right? So they don't have the intention or the capacity to really follow through. So that means, you know, they may have a significant shareholding initially, but then as time goes on and you raise larger sums of money, those investments become diluted. So it's not the worst thing in the world if initially you take on some investors that you're not aligned with, because you'll find the good ones later on that will dilute the earlier holdings.
So just moving on to, I suppose, where you're at now, and obviously the raising's not necessarily done, but you've been through that process a couple of times, and in terms of the product, you are taking it to international markets, I know, because we've done a little bit of work with you on that side of things. So would you define yourselves as a scale up? Is that where you're at, or do you care about those kinds of definitions?
I think, yeah, yes. I mean, I can almost call it as a Series A is the definition of scale up for me. What it means is, you know, when you raise money initially, it's like, right, here's some money, go and try the idea and come back and tell if it worked, right? Then the next stage is, yeah, we've got some initial interest, it's working, but we need a little bit more to just prove something more. Series A is, we've gotten the formula, you know, so, what's that linear regression formula? I can't remember it. A plus B equals Y or something like that. So you can plug your numbers into the formula. And the more money you plug into the formula, the higher results are. And that's the definition of scale up. There's no more doubt around, you know, what do you need to put in to get something out? You know, there's a very clear path to putting $1 in will give you $1.70 out.
Yeah. Okay. So so from your perspective, it's quite easy to determine when you're at that point. I suppose the risk for, you know, a lot of early stage startups is they misinterpret their readiness to scale up. Because if you're still fixing things up on the foundation, there's no point, you know, building the building on top of it. And building the plane whilst you drive it. It's all part of building a startup. We understand that, but it's a lot easier the more you can get right before you take off as well. So are there any lessons in that, you know, for yourself in hindsight, timing that Series A and understanding, like, you know, did you wait too long after you had that foundation in place, or did you jump the gun and actually there were still a lot of growing pains throughout that, or anything in that space?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of mistakes made. I suppose that the challenge is not to be too critical in yourself on those mistakes that you made, because you don't know what the alternative should have been and whether it would have a different result, right? So take whatever advice I give with a pinch of salt. I think the difficult part is, in a lot of the experiments that you go through in order to try and get to scale, and try and bring that client flow and client interest and client numbers forward, costs a lot of money. You know, be that through hiring people, be it through your own attempts at digital marketing, be it through, you know, throwing money at PR, and all of those things initially you think will bring brand awareness and clients. It's for me, it's been a huge lesson in that, coming from a corporate world, I never spoke to marketing people. I was never aware of the brand. Anybody would take my call. We received more inbound phone calls than I was making calls outside. So to build that brand and get that reputation is something that initially you try and buy. You know, you try to spend money on marketing, you try to spend money on PR agencies, you try to spend money on events, and you expect immediate results, and they just don't come. It's a function of time. And, you know, I know, you know, you guys are particularly active in the accounting world, and so are we. And I would say in that industry, especially when you're working with other people's money, is that trust takes a long time to build. And I can understand why. You know, when a accountant is putting their brand and their reputation at risk to recommend a service offering to the underlying clients, they're taking significant risk, because their reputation is one of their differentiating factors. Their brand is important to them. So, you know, they want to see that a startup's been around for a while, that they are going to be around for, you know, years to come, and that the product is of high quality. And that's not something you can buy with money up front. It's not something you can buy time with.
Was that something you've learnt in your experience so far? Was that a mistake that you guys made, or you were aware that, you know, with your background, that was an industry that's going to take a lot of time to build that?
No worries. We learned the hard way. You know, again, like, you come from a personal perspective, again, working in a big bank, and, you know, you come from the point where you say something and people will trust that as gospel, right? Now you have to convince people. You know, you can't say to them, listen, I ran billions of dollars of portfolio on a system, and trust me, you know, this team knows what they're doing. They don't care. You know, they need to see it in action, and they need to build a relationship with you. They need to see you in the market for a while. They need to test your product. So that's something that we were delusional, whatever the word you want to call. It takes a hell of a lot longer than it is. We've been going now for just over 2 years, and we're getting, you know, amazing traction now, but it's taken that time. We thought it would take 6 months. You know, it's taken a lot longer than we thought.
Francois, just to ask you on the back of that, how, especially early on, how do you ensure when you try those different initiatives, marketing initiatives, building your brand, that you spend the minimum possible to learn the maximum as quickly as possible and don't just burn too much cash, which 2023 startup environment, obviously you can't just throw cash as much as you could a year or 2 years ago?
That's a good question. You know, I can criticize, you know, a lot of the things that we, you know, tried and failed, but who knows that some of those things have led to discussions that we may not have had. You know, we won the X15 ventures the other day with CBA. Who knows what path that takes us down, you know, eventually. And how did X15 find out about us, for example? May have been something that we did 6 months or 12 months ago to put us on a certain radar. But how do you know up front? I would say is, don't benchmark yourself against what you perceive other successful companies and what they're doing at a certain stage. Everybody is on their own journey. So if you see somebody in the AFR, and they've been going for 18 months or 2 years, don't think you need to be in the AFR immediately. You know, the money's not going to get you there. Wait your turn. It will eventually, you know, it will eventually come in its own merit. So I think that's, for me, it's almost my biggest lesson is you steer your course. Your journey is unique to yourself. Learn from others out there and experiment in your ecosystem. But don't try and replicate others because you don't know what budget they have. You don't know what connections they have. It's so different.
Francois, you touched on something that's spot on with a metaphor for this whole podcast with the tar pit. But how do you find that balance learning from others and what they're doing, but understanding where, to be honest, it's just bullshit. And, you know, it appears success, like they're doing something successful on the outside and they sometimes attributing it to things publicly, which maybe in private is not what they're actually doing. How do you not fall in the tar pit of things that look good on the outside, but actually learn from what is really important?
What's worked for us is just surrounding yourself with people with experience. It's a relatively small market out there. And I'll call it small, whether you're talking about the UK, whether you're talking about Australia, any given market in any industry is highly specialized. You know, London is a big place and Australia is a big place. But when you start condensing it down into the markets, if you go into the bookkeeper's market or you're going to the accountant's market, it gets really small. You know, so if you surround yourself with the right people and get the right advisors on board, you can actually learn a lot and avoid a lot of those mistakes. To try and do all of this on your own and think that you're super smart based on some success that you've had in the past, whichever definition of success you've had, I think you've got a high probability of failing. Take other people on the journey with you. I know this is not the purpose of this podcast, but you know, that's where you guys deliver an amazing service. You know, you enable people to actually go on that journey and speak with the experts up front and learn the truth and get the truth out of the way so that you can focus on the areas that you need to experiment on. Get the known knowns out of the way and then go and focus on the stuff that you need to experiment on.
And as part of that, you know, the journey that we had together, and I remember some of the early conversations we had, Francois, the approach that you were taking was to go directly to the companies, and I suppose that strategy you kind of decided to focus a little bit more on finance teams and accountants and bookkeepers as well. So I suppose, you know, to kind of wrap up this podcast with the last few minutes to talk specifically about the accounting side, what do you think the opportunity is, and you know, the unique opportunity that is presented to startups that are working with accountants or trying to work with accountants, but also, you know, maybe there are unique challenges that come along with that?
The opportunity to work with accountants is really appealing. I think that there's two strategies you can take in terms of working with the accounting industry. Some people see accountants as salespeople. So what people really want is access to the underlying clients, and they try and use the accountants as salespeople. I think that's a mistake. That's not what accountants want to do. The approach that we've taken is that the accountants are our clients. So yes, they happen to onboard underlying clients, but we are enriching both the underlying clients as well as the accountants' lives. And I think that's it's a very different strategy that you need to take. The other thing is that the benefit of obviously working with accountants is that it is sticky business. It takes a long time to build trust, you know, for them to get to know you, for you to get to know the product. But once you build that relationship, it's a long-term relationship. Because a very quick reminder is, you know, nothing that we do, or I suppose I'll go as far as to say any product that is coming out to the market is going to be anything new that the accountant's not already doing, right? So the accountant is already doing all of the services that anybody can really realistically think about at the moment. It may just be a very manual, inefficient process. So nobody's really reinventing fire. So when you go and show something to an accountant, it has to be very clear that your proposition is that significantly better than the current way that they are doing it, because the underlying end result may still be the same. They are currently offering that service or product to their client. So what are you going to do that is so different for them to take the risk of their reputation and go to their clients and disrupt their clients by saying, you know, I implemented the strategy for you 6 months ago, and I convinced you to follow this particular process with this spreadsheet, and I trained you up. And now I'm coming back to you to say, you need to stop that and now try this new product. Change management and reputation is a big challenge that you need to think about. And again, work into the time frames that you're thinking about launching and working with accountants.
Yeah, and I think the reputation, we speak about it as a little bit of a double-edged sword, in that if you build a really strong reputation with accountants, it can be incredibly beneficial and fruitful. But at the same time, if you harm that reputation, or you damage that, or you break that trust, then it can be a surefire way to kill your business. You know, there are big brands that have made these mistakes. I can name a few, which I won't, but you see them in the communities. The accountants very quickly communicate those messages with other accountants. They do talk quite a bit. And so, I agree with you. I think reputation is considerably important.
And I think a way to, if you want to call it, hedge the bet on that is to listen to the accountants. No, don't build a product and go and sell. Listen to your clients' needs, listen to their underlying clients' needs, and effectively build a product together. That's when you'll be successful. So despite having tech, and you think you're going to do a tech play, there's a big component of relationship management in that process as well, and building the trust and building something that people really need and want. And you only do that by taking the harsh critics and hard feedback on board, and building a solution as a community, I suppose.
I like that a lot, and I think it's probably a nice place to wrap things up. And I guess to do that, I'll just ask one final question, which we want to ask every founder that we speak to, which is there a classic tar pit mistake that looks great on the outside, a strategy, a decision, a plan that looks fantastic on the outside, but which from your perspective is something that, you know, people should avoid, new founders should really avoid?
It's a super, super hard question to answer. I suppose the general answer to that is if something seems to be good to be true, it is. We find that often, you know, when we have new salespeople that come on board, they very quickly come to you with this new opportunity. And then the opportunities find you because it is the impossible and it's not really a scalable solution. You know, so people would want to pay to Russia. You know, he's found the one client that wants to pay to Russia, and he thinks, you know, he's going to do a lot of FX with us if we could pay to Russia. They're like, well, sorry, we can't pay to Russia. So I would just, you know, always just do a bit of a sense check on something, like, you know, have you really stumbled upon gold, or is there a particular reason that nobody's addressed that deemed opportunity?
Yeah, we've actually had a similar, we've heard this similar comment before around, you know, the silver bullet, the one more feature that's going to unlock all of the golden opportunities. So a really good spot to finish, and a great lesson. Thank you, Francois, for a really insightful conversation. Appreciate your time.
You're welcome, guys. Always happy to speak to you.
Thank you once again for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed the episode. If you are a potential founder in your early stages of developing a product, or elsewhere in the journey struggling to achieve product market fit, we would love for you to reach out at www.earlyadoptershub.com. This has been another episode of the Accounting Tech Tar Pit, presented by Early Adopters Hub, the accelerator for accounting tech.